older it was in hand. In hand? One more day, then it would be out of his hands and he'd be off the hook, with a fat envelope of euros. He wondered if his wife Hazel would like another week in the sun. As the car idled at the traffic lights on the junction of Main Street and Jail Street, in his rear-view mirror he saw Mike O'Brien pull out of a parking space, scream down the street and drive straight through the red light. Who put ants in his knickers? Dunn couldn't wait for all this to be over. Another week in the sun? It was looking more attractive by the minute. Chapter 68. What are you doing? Boyd asked, peering over Lottie's shoulder. I'm checking flights to Rome, she said, cursing Ryanair and what seemed like a million boxes she must tick. Are you totally mad? Who's paying?
Me.
Well, that's a first. I've never in my life heard of a detective paying their way for anything to do with work. He wheeled over his chair and sat beside her. Don't look at what I'm doing and you won't have to tell any lies, she said, tapping the keyboard. Did you hear anything I said to you earlier? This is crazy. You said that already. Stop repeating yourself. I want nothing to do with it, Boyd stood up.
Who asked you?
Kirby glanced up at them, shaking his head. Why don't you go and do something useful? Lottie muttered. Like what? Boyd asked. Talk to Brown's lover Derek Hart again. See if you can get anything else out of him. He's holding something back. Follow up with that young priest in the bishop's house, Father Owen, is that his name? Talk to Patrick O'Malley, find the elusive Father Conn. Will I write you a list? They'd had no luck finding Father Conn, whoever he was, and she realised there was a lot of things they still hadn't got a handle on. Boyd kicked back the chair, clattering it into a radiator, grabbing his coat and banging the door on his way out. A flight was leaving at 1:30. She glanced at the clock. Enough time to get to the airport, if she hurried. €79, including taxes. Not too bad. She couldn't really afford it. Could she? The powers that be wouldn't reimburse her, unless she had prior approval, and she hadn't time for that. It was going to be at her own cost. But she needed to do this. Clicked it. For feck's sake, she said. What's up? Kirby glanced over his screen. Nothing. She looked in her drawer for a pill to calm her nerves. Couldn't find one. As she slid it shut, she noticed the old file. Alone in the midst of the chaos. Sitting. Waiting. For an answer? Could the old records now in Rome give her answers after all this time? If so, it would be worth the expense. €79 one way, return flight in the morning, another 55, she said. Kirby pretended he wasn't listening. Definitely can't afford it. She searched her wallet for her credit card. The bill was due. She bit her bottom lip, thinking, churning everything over in her head. Had Father Joe really found something useful? What if she was wrong about him? What if he was the one who murdered Sullivan and Brown, even Father Angelotti? What was the truth? But she realised, whatever she might owe on her visa bill, she owed this to the victims. She reached into the drawer and removed the old file on the missing boy. It haunted her like a tenacious ghost. Placing it beside her keyboard, she opened it and looked at the boy's photograph. Ran her finger over his freckles. Made her decision. If Corrigan wants to suspend me, might as well give him a good reason. Entered her card details. Transaction complete. Boarding card printed. Before she could change her mind. Shit! She ran both hands through her hair, scrunching it tight. What now? Asked Kirby. I've got to get someone to mind my kids. Kirby shook his head and went back to what he was doing.
That's definitely not on my CV.
Lottie dug her nails into her head. Swallowing her pride, she called her mother. Chapter 69. He must have fallen back asleep, because when he opened his eyes he could see a thin stream of light. The man, standing in the doorway. Jason blinked. He couldn't see properly.
"What do you want of me?"
he croaked.
"I'm not sure. Not sure at all. I picked you up on a whim. Never done that before. It felt quite exciting having such young flesh sitting beside me."
"You're a pervert." "Silly boy, calling me names. You might be sorry."
"What did you do to me? If you touched me, I swear to God my father will kill you."
"Going by what you told me last night, I would not count on him."
"Did you?"
Jason's voice quivered. "Did I what?" Jason knew he was being mocked. "Did I touch you?" "No. Not yet, anyway. Thinking about it. Long and hard." He laughed and rubbed his hand along his groin. Jason's body convulsed.
"Did you drug me?"
"A pill sent you to dreamland. I could not risk you fighting back. That would defeat the purpose of the exercise."
"What exercise?"
"As I say, I have not quite figured that out yet. Are you hungry?"
"I'm thirsty. Please untie me."
A gusty sound filled the room as the man snorted. "Maybe some food and water. Next time." He turned to leave.
"Please let me out of here. I want to go home,"
Jason said, breathing a white fog into the cold air. "You will do exactly what I tell you." The voice rose, then faded, trailing unspoken menace in its wake. The door clunked shut, and a key turned in the lock. Jason waited, listened. Scratching in the ceiling above him, and a bird cawing somewhere in the distance. That's all he heard. Otherwise, it was deathly silent. Chapter 70. After numerous protestations, Boyd agreed to cover for her. "It's only until tomorrow," Lottie said.
"I shouldn't. Thanks, Boyd.
I knew I could count on you." She squeezed his arm. "If asked, I'm searching the victims' homes again, following up clues, talking to suspects."
"What suspects? What clues?"
"Is there an echo in here?" Lottie cupped her ear. "You'll think of something." If Father Joe had found something worthwhile, she was in the clear, but Corrigan would probably suspend her anyway once he found out she had disobeyed his orders. Then again, he hadn't categorically said no, had he?
Feck him.
Back at home, Lottie emptied Sean's school rucksack, stacked his books on top of the dryer and ran upstairs to find clean clothes. Dragging shirts and sweaters from hangers, she watched the pile grow into a leaning tower on the bed. "What are you doing?" Chloe asked, standing in the doorway, still in her pajamas. "I'm going to Rome. Work stuff. I rang your grandmother to stay the night."
"What? Ah, no."
I know," Lottie said, "but I need to be sure you're all safe." She held a red satin blouse up to her chest, looking for approval. The 16-year-old scrunched up her nose and shook her head. "Let me have a look," she said. "What do you need?" "Something nice and clean." From the heap, Chloe extracted a cream silk blouse with tiny buttons, a strap top and a pair of dark brown jeans. "What do you think?" Chloe asked. "They'll go with your Uggs."
"Perfect," said Lottie.
"Will you fold them into the bag? You know what I'm like." She searched through her clothes, found a navy long-sleeve t-shirt and changed into it. Checked her jeans were presentable and decided they'd have to do.
"Someday I'm going to burn those t-shirts," Chloe said.
"They're comfortable.
I'm not so sure about that blouse, though.
It's stunning. You should try harder. You might catch a nice man, Chloe said.
Lottie stared at her daughter, eyebrows raised.
Where did that come from?
You need to go out to nice places and meet people. You're too young to be single for the rest of your life. I know Dad would want you to be with someone.
Chloe picked up a small tub of moisturiser from the dressing table.
I'll get a clear freezer bag for this. For security at the airport.
Lottie watched her daughter leave the room. It had never occurred to her that her children might want her to meet someone new. After all they'd gone through with Adam's illness, they continued to surprise her. Sitting on the bed, she contemplated her desecrated wardrobe. Noticing a thick knitted sweater on the top shelf, she leapt up and tugged it down. Adam's fishing sweater. Holding it to her nose, she craved a trace of him, but she knew it had been obliterated by the wash. His unique smell, clinging to his clothes, had been the only physical thing remaining before Rose Fitzpatrick had thrown everything into the washing machine last summer, complaining about moths. The rift that had been festering boiled over that day. Lottie had lost it with her mother, banished her from the house and cried into the basket of damp clothes. It wasn't her mother's fault. Deep down she knew that. But she had felt violated. All she had been left with was an overwhelming sense of loss. She clutched her little piece of Adam's memory tightly to her chest before folding it and stuffing it back on the shelf. She would have to make it up with her mother. Soon. Chloe returned with a clear plastic bag, threw in the jar of moisturiser, and placed it on the top of the rucksack.
"Have you packed a change of underwear?" Chloe asked.
Lottie rummaged in a drawer, pulled out a bra and knickers, shoved them in the bag.
"What would I do without you, Chloe Parker?"
"I really don't know, Mother," Chloe said, shaking her head with a laugh.
"Granny will be here soon. I suppose we can suffer her for one night.
Just one thing. Keep an eye on Katie. She was upset last night. And no fighting." Chloe rolled her eyes.
"It's always about Katie. What about me and Sean?"
"I know I can count on you. Please."
"Sure," the girl said. "I promise not to kill Katie. At least not until you get back. You watch out for those Italian stallions."
Lottie gave Chloe a tight squeeze and a kiss on the forehead and went to say goodbye to her other two children.
"Any word from Jason?"
she asked Katie.
"No," she said. "I'm going round our friends' houses in a while to see if I can find out anything."
"Don't be frettin'," Lottie said. "He probably smoked too much weed and conked out."
"Mam!"
"And when I get back, we're going to talk horticulture," Lottie said.
"What?"
"How to get rid of weeds." Katie smiled. Lottie hugged her. Sean was standing at the door.
"When can I get that new PlayStation?"
Lottie closed her front door just after 11 a.m. Boyd was leaning against his car. He took the bag from her shoulder.
"I'll drive," he said, getting into his own car.
"I don't want any sermons," Lottie said, sitting in beside him.
"And I don't understand what's got into you," he said, reversing the car.
"Okay, I'll say nothing about it. Have you eaten?"
She shook her head. He leaned over, took a bar of chocolate from the glove compartment, and threw it on her lap. Boyd concentrated on driving on the icy roads, and they travelled in silence, reaching the airport in 50 minutes despite the weather. He parked in a set-down bay outside departures. She hustled the rucksack to her knee.
"If I'm wrong about this, so be it. But I owe it to the victims to find out anything I can."
"It's career suicide, you know that. You shouldn't go," he said.
"Watch me," she said.
As straight as she could, Lottie walked through the glass doors, her stride carrying her with a sense of vague purpose. Probably because she hadn't a clue what she was doing.
Boyd drove back to Ragmullen without dispelling his anger. He sat down at Lottie's desk wondering how she was going to get herself out of this mess. However much of a maverick she was, this was crossing the line. The office seemed hollow without her. Like his heart. He picked up her coffee mug. Untidy Lottie. As he got up, he touched the old file on her desk. She guarded it like a state secret. He'd never been bothered with it before. Now, though, his interest piqued. He opened the cover. The boy in the photograph had an impish twist to his lips, as if he was contemplating what mischief he could get up to next. Boyd read quickly. Incarcerated in St. Angela's. Reported missing by his mother when the authorities at the institution informed her that he had absconded. He looked at the boy's name again. Immediately he knew why the file and the missing boy were so important to Lottie. Why hadn't she trusted him enough to tell him? Did their friendship count for nothing? He continued to read, and when he had finished, Boyd wondered if he really knew anything at all about Lottie Parker. Chapter 71. Alighting from the airport express train at Rome Termini, Lottie's skin tingled with anticipation. It was a mild evening under a light sprinkling of rain. She put her watch ahead to reflect the 1 hour time difference. Stepping onto the cobblestone street, she crossed the road. She'd never been in Rome before, but had studied the map on the train, memorizing the directions to her hotel. Straight ahead, then left, and she should be beside it. And she was. She stood in a small piazza facing the Basilica di Santa Maria Maggiore. Its magnificence halted her. Bells rang out the sixth hour, and the square came to life, as pigeons flew from picking damp crumbs on the cobbles to soar into the grey sky. Entering the hotel foyer, she was immediately blinded by the incredible marble floors and walls. The male receptionist greeted her.
Buongiorno, signora.
Lottie loved his accent and wished she could converse in Italian. Confirming her reservation, he presented her with a key.
It's our deluxe room, signora. Elevator to the fourth floor.
Grazie, Lottie said. At least she knew one word in Italian. At the end of a white marbled corridor, she found her room. Compact, clean and welcoming. Silently, she thanked Father Joe for finding this place at short notice when she texted him from Dublin Airport. And he insisted on paying for it. Out of diocesan funds, he said. She didn't argue. She opened the window and the sounds of Rome swirled around outside, then settled into the room. The scent of aromatic coffee rose up from the espresso bar below. The view across the rooftops filled her with excitement. She'd love to see the sights. Not this time, though. The shower was a struggling stream of tepid water. She persevered and emerged energized. Dressed in her brown jeans and long-sleeve cream silk shirt. In front of the mirror, she opened the top two buttons and let the collar hang loose. That's better, she thought, before buttoning them up again. She checked her watch. Father Joe would be waiting for her. The narrow winding streets carried her deep into the heart of old Rome. Cars honked, mopeds sped by and sirens wailed. As the drizzle cleared, she eventually exited the maze of cobbles to see St. Peter's Basilica across the Tiber, shimmering in the glow of streetlights. She crossed over a bridge and made her way into Vatican City. Checking the streets against the directions on the text message, she turned a corner and saw him.
Inspector Parker, welcome to Rome.
Great to see you, she said, and held out her hand, surprised she'd found him so quickly. He grabbed her in a bear hug. She felt a hot flush race up her cheeks. He released her and held her at arm's length.
You've lost weight since I saw you last.
Working too hard. And those bruises look worse.
Lottie grinned.
Don't be daft. You saw me a couple of days ago.
I'm glad you came, he said.
I want to show you all of Rome. You'll love it.
I'm here to work, she warned. I've only a few hours.
Enjoy it while you're here, he said. A quick tour of the Basilica, before it closes?
She knew she should get down to business straight away, but she also wanted to see the building.
Okay, but let's not delay.
As she walked by his side, he pointed out exterior architectural features before guiding her up the steps and through the security check.
Wow, she said, catching her breath.
Inside was as splendid as the outside. Incense filled the atmosphere. They swept up and down the impressive aisles. Lottie was drawn to Michelangelo's Pietà, its polished stone gleaming under spotlights, behind protective glass. The Virgin, her face sorrowful yet resigned, as she held her dead son in her arms. Lottie thought of Adam, and how she'd embraced his body as he cooled in death. She hoped she'd never have to hold her son thus. A gasp escaped her mouth, and Father Joe put his hand on her shoulder.
It's beautiful, she whispered.
Magnificent, he said. They left the Basilica and walked along narrow laneways, stopping after 10 minutes in front of a 15-foot-high wooden door. Father Joe refused to answer her questions along the way, telling her he was bringing her to the source of his find. He pushed an intercom button. A grainy voice answered in Italian and the door creaked open. A narrow vestibule lay before them with a fountain commanding the center, surrounded by prancing stone cherubs. Numerous stairways meandered up to apartments. It reminded Lottie of Gregory Peck's abode in the film Roman Holiday. She half expected Audrey Hepburn to pop her head around one of the staircases. A door opened 2 floors above them, and a rotund, 5-foot man, dressed in a flowing black robe, took flight down the stairs, a string of Italian emanating from him in a melodic tune.
"Joseph, Joseph," he said, wrapping his arms around Father Joe.
"Father Umberto." "This is Detective Inspector Lottie Parker," Father Joe said, extracting himself from the embrace. "The Irish detective I mentioned to you?" The small man leaned up on his toes and brushed his cheek to hers.
"Umberto," he said. "Call me Umberto."
"You can call me Lottie." She followed, as Father Umberto led Father Joe by the hand up the stairs, like a mother bringing a child home from school. A door stood wide open at the top. Squeezing into the room, Lottie was astonished at the number of books scattered everywhere. The small priest attempted to tidy up, hands flapping in a fluster.
"Excuse me, I no time to tidy," he said in broken English.
His spectacles appeared glued to his nose, as if he had grown too fat for them. Lottie sat at a mahogany bureau overflowing with paperwork. The two priests chatted in Italian. Lottie caught Father Joe's eye.
"Perhaps we should converse in English," he said.
"Si,"
the Italian said.
"Umberto, please tell Inspector
Lottie
why Father Angelotti went to Ireland," Father Joe said.
Umberto was suddenly reticent, his ebullience disappearing.
"He is dead.
It is, how you say, terrible."
He blessed himself and bowed his head. When his mumbled intercessions ended, his eyes darted round the room.
"I know it be bad. I know."
"What do you mean?" Lottie asked. A church bell rang out and she flinched. It might well have been in the room with them.
"I think he tried to cover up. Cover up mistakes."
Umberto suddenly sat down on the floor. There was nowhere else to sit. "Father Umberto is curator of Irish pastoral records," Father Joe explained. "That is, any files or correspondence sent to the Pope from the bishops, he is responsible for cataloguing and filing them. In recent times, some Irish diocesan records have been housed here. His immediate superior was Father Angelotti."
Umberto pried off his spectacles, and his earlier passionate fervour transformed into intense weeping. Lottie stared out through the tiny window to avoid looking at him. Emotional men were not her forte.
I'm sorry. So upset. Angelotti, he my friend.
Father Joe asked. Can I get you some water?
No, I okay. I cannot believe my dear friend will not come home. It break my heart.
His shoulders rose and fell as more sobs tore from him. Lottie questioned Father Joe with her eyes. He turned his head, avoiding her gaze. Can you help us? She implored Father Umberto.
I help, see.
He rose to his feet, squeezing his spectacles on his nose. No one can hurt me, see? He wiped away his tears, attempting to restore a modicum of calm. Why did Father Angelotti go to Ireland? Lottie asked, hoping the priest would tell them something worthwhile soon. Time was slipping by quickly, and the prospect of losing her job seemed more realistic with each passing second.
He get correspondence. That is why he go.
Do you have a copy of this correspondence? She asked.
No. A message. On his phone.
But you must know something, she persisted. The priest sighed, glanced at Father Joe, then turned his attention to Lottie.
I no remember when.
Summer, maybe.
He received phone call from a man, James Brown. He asks for investigation into St. Angela's. He say it sell for small money. He say Father Angelotti must also look for adopted baby. You understand?
My English not good.
Lottie said, I understand.
Father Angelotti, he spent many hours with the ledgers after that. I know there was more correspondence with this James. Father Angelotti, he tell me he must go. He say he make big mistake. He say he must talk to people, to make things right.
What mistake? Lottie asked.
He say he mix up numbers. That is all he say. He tell me not to ask questions, so I no ask.
Can I show Inspector Parker the ledgers? Father Joe asked. The priest nodded.
My dear friend is dead, he paused, then said, I go for passeggiata, a walk. Then I tell no lies when I do not see.
He pulled on a coat and without another word went out into the night, leaving them alone. Father Joe stood up. Bishop Connor ordered all of the old St. Angela's ledgers to be moved from Ireland to here. It was about 2 years ago. I've no idea why. They're now stored in the basement. Come, he said, and opened a door which Lottie thought was a bathroom. It revealed a winding staircase. Surely they should be in a more secure location, Lottie asked. This is secure. There's a multitude of offices like this one scattered all over Rome. Very few people know about them. They reached the bottom of three flights of stairs. A thick wooden door lay open, an iron key in its lock. Lottie looked at Father Joe and entered the room. Chapter 72.
This place is unbelievable, Lottie said.
Shelf after shelf of leather-bound ledgers. History consigned to the back streets of Rome. Father Joe opened a ledger on the desk. St. Angela's, he said. Lottie breathed deeply, realizing that she'd been holding her breath. He carefully turned the faded pages until he reached the year he was looking for, 1975. She glanced at him before perusing what had been written decades before. Lists. Names, ages, dates, sex. All female.
What are we looking at?
She asked, though she had already guessed. These pages refer to the girls placed in St. Angela's in 1975, he said. I've gone through it, but I can't find a Susan Sullivan anywhere. Lottie sat down, turned the leaves, reading through the lists. Here she is, she said. Sally Steins. She changed her name. She traced her finger along the row. That's why I couldn't find her, he said. These are reference numbers, she declared. This one, beside Sally's name, AA113. What does it mean? It refers to another ledger somewhere here, he said. I haven't found it yet. But look at this. He handed her another smaller book. Sweet Jesus, she whispered. I don't believe it. Dates of births, dates of death. Joe, they were only babies and little children. Lottie scanned the pages, horror choking her. I know, he said quietly. Cause of death? Measles. Colic. Unknown, she read. My God. Where did they bury them? I've no idea. It all seems so methodical, impersonal, she said. These were people's children. I'm not sure it has anything to do with your investigations. The reference number you pointed out, I can't see it here, he said, leaning over her shoulder. Lottie tried to control her trembling body. Shocking media headlines of dead babies in septic tanks came back to her. It was international news a few years ago. Now her hands held evidence of something similar. Was that why the books had been relocated? She went back to the first ledger he'd shown her. This ledger, she said, only lists female admissions. There were boys in St. Angela's. She remembered the missing boys' file, buried in her drawer. Another mystery associated with St. Angela's. She hoped this place might throw some light on it. They'll be in another ledger. I'll keep looking. There were so many children in that school over the years, he said, pointing to the rows of black spines on the shelves. Don't call it a school, she said, thumping the table, unable to suppress her anger any longer. It was an institution, one that slipped under the radar. Until now. His voice was flat, resigned. Who is this Father Cornelius who signed each page? Lottie asked, diverting her eyes from the tragedy scripted before her. Could he be the Father Conn that O'Malley referred to? He must be, she thought. Father Joe pulled down another ledger from the shelf. You have to see this first, he said, opening a page he'd already marked. This set of records is like a tracking device, he explained. It lists priests and where they served. Lottie took the small ledger and placed it on top of the others with trembling hands. The name headlined the page in neat ink script, Father Cornelius Mohan. The rows beneath it confirmed movement between parishes and dioceses. No reason given for such transfers. Most priests might serve 3, maybe 4 parishes in a lifetime, Father Joe said. But there must be 20, 30 here. She ran her finger down the page, counting. Then she turned to the next one. More parishes. She kept on counting. He served in 42 different parishes throughout the country, she said, shaking her head. Tells a story, doesn't it? He said. A statement, not a question. He paced the confined space. He moved around because of abuse? She asked. Doesn't state it, but priests are not normally shifted from parish to parish in that fashion. I'm sure there are bulging files of allegations on him, somewhere. Jesus Christ! His last address is in Ballinacloy. That's not far from Ragmullen, Lottie said. Do you know if he's still alive? I'm sure I would have heard if he had died, even if he is retired, Father Joe said, nodding his head, his shoulders slumped. He must be in his 80s. Do you know him? Have you met him?
I don't know him. I was shocked when I discovered this. Someone manually updated these ledgers. None of this goes on a computer. Would you want this traced? Not the Catholic Church. It would want this hushed up, hidden and covered up. Can I make copies? That's not allowed. Lottie observed him for a moment, and his eyes told her what she needed to know. She fingered the phone in her pocket. "Didn't you say you have to use the bathroom?" she asked. "Don't tear out any pages," he said. He knew what she was planning. "Thank you. I'm trusting you." Listening to Father Joe slowly climb the staircase, Lottie thought his footsteps sounded heavy with the weight of the sins of his church. She felt physically ill studying the script, couldn't read any more, so she quickly photographed the pages with her phone camera. She tried to record as much of the large book as she could. Calculating a grid in her head, she photographed in chronological order. She would piece them together on her own computer. "This will not remain hidden," she vowed silently. The names inked on the page seemed so impersonal, devoid of humanity. She wanted to read each one in her own time. They referenced a life story, a heartbeat, and a heartbreak. And she was confident they related to the current murders in Ragmullen. James Brown and Susan Sullivan had spent time together in St. Angela's, and she was sure the connection to their murders was buried somewhere in this dungeon of ledgers. When she finished photographing, she turned her attention to the shelves and scanned the dates inscribed on the dusty spines. Early 1900s, up to 1980s. She doubled back and plucked out a thin 1970s ledger with references A100 to AA500. She located what she thought to be the relevant pages, hurriedly photographed without reading, and returned it to the shelf. She reached for the boys' ledgers. She discovered them on a bottom shelf, found 1975, photographed each page, and returned the ledger to its dusty resting place. She did the same for the first half of 1976. She couldn't bring herself to read it all now. And she wondered why Father Joe hadn't just photographed the pages and emailed them to her. The door opened. Father Joe stood with his hands thrust deep in his pockets. "You inferred last night," Lottie said, "that all this had something to do with Bishop Connor, but I don't see any evidence here." "Look at the signature at the end of each row of the priest's movements," he instructed. She did. A spindly crawl. But there was no doubt whose name it was. Terence Connor. "I need to ring Boyd," she said. "Why?" "I want him to talk to this Father Cornelius Mohan. He served in Ragmullen Parish and was assigned to St. Angela's for 3 years. She looked at her phone. No signal. "Let's get some air," she said. Nausea threatened to overcome her after what she just read. Brushing past Father Joe, taking 2 steps at a time, she hurried, as if the dead had risen from the dusty pages and were following in her footsteps. Outside, she walked in small circles under a street light. The tall buildings, leaning inwards, appeared to be grasping the shadows and throwing them around her like gravel in a sandpit. "Will you continue to search the other ledgers for me?" she asked. "See what you can find. I'm sure everything connects to St. Angela's." "Yes, of course," Father Joe said. "But how can you be sure?" "It has to be a cover-up, and the mistake Father Angelotti made must have something to do with the reference numbers." Lottie tapped her phone. Things are beginning to make some sense. She checked the signal and called Boyd. Chapter 73. It was closing time at the gym. The thump-thump music was consigned to the depths of nowhere, and someone was flicking the lights on and off. Boyd completed his warm-down, switched off the treadmill, and hurried to the locker room.
Mike O'Brien was buttoning his shirt at the neck, twisting in his cufflinks, his face red, bulging from exertion. He had turned his back and was pulling on his jacket when Boyd's phone rang. Boyd checked the caller ID, swore, and answered.
"Boyd," he said, and listened as Lottie spoke. "Father Cornelius Moen," he repeated, searching his gym bag. "I can't find a pen. Hold on."
O'Brien held out a ballpoint, extracted from his breast pocket. Boyd took it, nodding a thank you.
"Go ahead." "Yes, I have that."
"Ballinacloy."
"Very good." "Yep, straight away."
He wanted to ask Lottie a whole lot more, but she'd hung up on him.
"And I love you too," he said, sarcastically, to the phone in his hand.
He handed the pen back to O'Brien, lifted his bag and left the gym without any small talk. Ballinacloy, a village of almost 200 souls or sinners, whichever way you wanted to look at it, was situated 15 kilometres outside Ragmullen, on the old Athlone Road. Out in the yard, Father Cornelius Moen packed turf into a basket. A cigarette hung from his chapped lips. Proud of his agility at his age, he was frustrated with how the snow had debilitated him. He feared falling and fracturing a hip. As he turned to go back inside, the light dimmed. Someone had walked in front of the door, blocking the glow of the bulb. The old priest raised his white head and looked directly into a set of dark eyes. He felt pain grasp his heart and his breathing laboured. The turf basket crashed to the ground and the cigarette fell from his mouth onto the snow, sizzling for a moment before the red butt blackened and extinguished.
"Remember me?"
the voice echoed, distorted by a gust of wind. The old priest looked at the face, partially shielded by a black hood. Though the face was older, the eyes held the same coldness from long ago, an emotionless being he himself had helped nurture. And he knew a day like this would come. Turning away, he kicked the basket and tried to run. His old legs refused to move quickly.
"Go away," he shouted. "Leave me be." "So you do remember me."
A hand grabbed his shoulder. The priest shrugged it off and hobbled to the corner of the house before he stumbled on an iron grill over a drain. As he fell backwards, his assailant jumped on top of him, pinning him to the ground.
"What do you want from me?"
the old priest croaked.
"You stole from me."
The tone was menacing.
"I never stole anything in my life." "You stole my life." "Your life was already nothing," he spat. "You should thank me for saving you from evil." "You introduced me to evil, you mad old bastard. All my life I've waited for this moment, and now at last I can send you on your way to the eternal fires. Go to hell."
Father Cornelius was already struggling for air when the cord tightened around his throat. He thought he heard the ringing of bells before his world went black. Boyd kept his finger pressed on the doorbell. It was bright inside, and he could see the backyard light on. No answer.
"Come on,"
he told Lynch, and walked around the side of the house. The yard was lit by a solitary bulb, too low a wattage to cast light any distance. The moon, though low in the sky, cast the trees in a soft silhouette. Lynch tiptoed behind him. He was glad he'd called her. He needed the company. At the rear of the house, a figure lay motionless on the ground. Boyd struck out his arm, stopping Lynch in her tracks.
"What?"
she asked, bumping into him. Boyd looked back at her, put a finger to his lips and listened.
"Wait here,"
he whispered, an inch towards the figure, careful not to walk on anything that might be evidence. He crouched over the white-haired priest and held two fingers to his throat. He knew his action was fruitless when he saw the cord tight around the neck. The face was blue under the dim light,
the tongue protruding and the unseeing eyes appeared to be staring straight through him. The rancid stench of defecation and death wafted up, obliterating all other smells. Boyd rose up and scanned his surroundings as far as the weak bulb allowed.
Lynch.
What? The bushes. Over there. I thought I saw something. I don't see anything. There, do you see it?
Boyd ran through the garden in the dark.
Wait! Lynch shouted. Where do you think you're going?
He vaulted the hedge and pressed on his phone light. It began to ring. He ignored the tone, concentrating on the dark figure running ahead of him along the narrow lane.
Boyd, you idiot! Lynch yelled. Wait!
He ran fast, slipping and sliding, trying to keep the target in sight. Branches smashed into his face, wet leaves flew back and violently slapped into him. A thorn bush tore up his nostril, and a branch scratched his head. He needed to catch his prey. It was the killer. He was sure. Adrenaline fueled his legs, and he subconsciously thanked the hours he'd spent sweating in the gym. The moonlight was strong, but it was difficult running on the slippery paving stones. His breathing rattled, fast and hollow. A wheelie bin crashed across his path, and the shadow sped up the alley. At the end, a wall. Boyd climbed over it in one movement and followed the spectre into the night. Ahead of him, a field stretched into obscurity. He stopped, catching his breath. Which direction did he go? Boyd couldn't see a thing. Frustration welled up and he swore. Without hearing a sound, he felt something encircle his neck. He flung up his hands, grasping at nothingness, cursing his idiocy. He was strong, but caught unawares, he was at a disadvantage. Lottie would have something to say about this, he thought wildly. He elbowed the man behind him. The grip remained steadfast. He kicked back. His foot crashed against bone. Good. The noose tightened. Bad. Blackness descended, while the cold air waited in a dark chill around him. He felt powerless and hysterical simultaneously. His throat constricted, his hands flailed, the cable tightened. He desperately fought the compression. But his knees weakened and snow seeped into his bones. He couldn't see anything, but he sensed the man leaning over him. A knife sliced through his clothes, into his flesh. A sharp pain in his side. He gurgled a cry. His phone rang in a distant sphere. Lottie would be totally pissed off with him for dying on her. A knee bore into his spine. He gagged, and the moon lit up the shadows for 1 second, before complete darkness plunged like a black veil over a widow's face. Darkness. Chapter 74 Lottie felt Father Joe's arm slide through hers, steering her along the walled city through Borga Pio and across the river. I hope the ledgers help you, he said. How is the overall investigation going?
Don't ask.
You don't want to talk about it?
Not with you, Joe.
You're still a suspect.
An uneasy tinge crept into her voice.
He laughed.
Ah, there's gratitude for you. I told you I could be excommunicated for what I've just shown you.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I still can't understand why Father Angelotti travelled to Ragmullen, she said. It seemed implausible that he went on the basis of correspondence with James Brown.
I don't know, he said, leaning in closer to her as they walked.
You don't know what?
Why he travelled to Ragmullen?
They looked back across the Tiber at St. Peter's Basilica. Father Joe scratched his head.
Lottie, there are niggly things crawling around in my brain, and I don't like that feeling.
Go on, she said.
There's always been scandal associated with the Catholic Church throughout the centuries. In recent decades,
There's the rumours of inappropriate financial dealings and the disgraceful child sex abuse cases. He closed his eyes for a moment. I think maybe Father Angelotti was on a mission to cover up something that was threatening to explode. I'll try to find out who might have sent him. But it is possible he acted on his own initiative. There have been a multitude of abuse cases. The Chum babies, the Magdalen laundries. Why now? Why kill him? It doesn't make sense. Lottie raised her hands, then lowered them. He gripped her arm, turning her towards him. None of it does, Lottie. But there has to be a plausible motive or scenario. And when you study the copies of the ledgers, I'm sure you will find something. This case is like a spaghetti junction, she said, feeling his fingers through her jacket. Going everywhere and nowhere. No leads, no nothing. And moving those records to Rome, it's very unorthodox. Not unorthodox. Just the Catholic Church doing what it does best. Covering up. He began walking again. I'll go back to Umberto in the morning and look through the other ledgers. I appreciate all you're doing, you know that. But I'm still a suspect, he asked. Lottie said nothing. They strolled the rest of the way in silence. Standing on the pavement outside her hotel, Lottie asked, Where are you going now? I don't know, to be honest. She felt soft raindrops on her head. Do you want to come in for a coffee? She didn't want to be alone with the images conjured up by the old ledgers, and she felt Joe could be her friend. Perhaps I will, he answered, and followed her into the warm lobby. Shit, she said. What's wrong? The bar is closed. Perhaps I should have booked a more upmarket hotel for you, he joked. Lottie thought for a moment. This is not very appropriate, but do you want to come up to my room? There's a kettle and cups there. Inspector Parker, that is a totally inappropriate suggestion, he said, a smile brightening his face. One which I accept. In the elevator, Lottie put space between them, gripped her bag to her chest and sighed. What was she after doing now? She liked Father Joe. But was it like a brother, or was it something more? She wasn't at all sure. The room was as she left it. Curtains fluttered in the breeze, and the scent of fresh rain rested on the windowsill. When she turned, he was standing directly behind her. The room was suddenly too small. Excuse me, she said, sliding past him to grab the kettle. She filled it with water from the bathroom. When she returned, he was sitting on the narrow wooden chair at the desk, his coat thrown over at the end of the bed. He hadn't uttered a word since they'd left the lobby. She flicked on the switch, busied herself tearing open the miserable coffee sachets, and poured the small grains into cups. A wave of exhaustion seeped through her sinews. She rubbed the back of her neck. He was out of the chair and standing behind her. Shh, he said, massaging the spot where her fingers had been. Tremors travelled like lightning down to her toes. Holy God, she thought. I'm like a cliché. He's a priest. It's okay. He's only rubbing my tired neck. She felt the sleeve of his sweater rough against the silk of her blouse. She smelled his soft soap. She stood still, entombed by his touch, and wondered if she was craving this contact so that he might absolve her of all the horrors of the last few hours, the last few days, and the last few years, and of the horrors yet to be revealed. That's enough now, Joe, she laughed nervously and wriggled away from him. She began busying herself with the kettle. Let's have that coffee. Of course, he said, sitting down on the chair. Handing him a cup, she said, I hope I haven't given off wrong signals. I like you as a friend. Nothing more. My life is complicated enough. He laughed then, and the tension in the room seemed to slip out the window with the billowing curtain. Dear God, I hope I wasn't being improper. I was only trying to release the pressure from your neck. It's been a tough day for you. She felt a blush sweep up her cheeks. Shit. She had made a fool of herself. She put down the cup and turned away. He stood up and placed his hands on her shoulders, forced her to look at him. You are a good woman, Lottie Parker. I want you to know that I will be your friend, and I'll do my best to help you solve the murders. He held out his hand. Friends? Yes, Lottie said, and shook his hand. He clasped her hand, holding it in his own. He left then, without saying anything further. Leaning against the door, she listened to his steps disappearing down the marble corridor. She waited for her breathing to return to normal. She waited for the chiming of the Maggiore bells. When at last she could move, Lottie tried phoning Boyd. She just wanted to hear a familiar voice. No answer. She looked out over the city and counted the silhouetted spires. She counted the car horns and the sirens. As her body relaxed, she flipped open her laptop. She needed to go home. Tonight. Finding a flight leaving in 2 hours, she booked it and hurriedly stuffed everything into her rucksack, left the hotel and ran to catch the shuttle train. She called Boyd again. No answer. Chapter 75. A bell tinkled and a light flickered above his head. Jason opened his eyes and turned his head slowly, focusing through the shadows. Time for a little ceremony, server boy. The voice chanted a hum of incantations. A light dimmed and flickered. What do you want? Jason croaked. Whatever you have to offer me will never be enough. My father. This is partly his fault, so you can blame him. What? What do you mean? You don't need to concern yourself with it. Jason squeezed his eyes shut to keep tears from escaping. Hands unshackled him, hauled him to his feet. A finger trailed down his spine. The man exhaled a loud sigh and pushed him out the door, along a corridor and down steps. He was in a small chapel. The man carried a bell, clanging it in time to some unknown beat within his body. The wooden pews offered Jason no comfort. He was forced to stand, hypnotized by the scene before him. Dressed in a flowing white robe, buttoned from hem to neck, the man sang his mad tune, his voice rising and falling, almost in time to the candles blowing soft and slow in a captured breeze. I killed a man tonight, said the sing-song voice. Jason grew cold, though his skin radiated sweat. Combined with whatever drugs he'd been fed, the flickering candles and the incessant chanting, he felt dizzy. Actually, I might have killed too. The hysterical laugh resonated throughout the stone vestibule. A crow circled high in the rafters and flew into a stained glass window, a feather floating through the air in its wake. A mist descended over Jason's eyes as the marble welcomed his fall. He hit the floor and lay unconscious beside the black feather. Chapter 76. Lottie leaned against the oval airplane window. Closing her eyes, she thought of the few hours she had spent in Rome, her mind consumed by the old ledgers. Numbers scrolled through her mind. Susan Sullivan was a number. Her child was a number. Suddenly, she sat bolt upright in the seat, waking the woman beside her. I'm sorry, Lottie said. I think we've another hour to go. The woman scrunched her chin into her chest and went back to sleep. Lottie stared at the seat in front of her. What was within her grasp? A clue. Something she'd already seen but hadn't yet registered. It wouldn't come. She knew it would. The photographic evidence was on her phone. Once it was uploaded, she was sure she could tie it all together. Jealous of the woman with the soft snores, she couldn't rest easy. She needed